May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our Lord and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. God's peace and good morning. There are fascinating commentaries on this specific parable. If you look back in the patristic era, that's, you know, first 500 to 700 years of the church. Good stuff, by the way, if you ever want some hefty reading. You have the greats like Augustine and Hilary of Poitiers. You have Caesarius of Arles. You know, these phenomenal writers that dig into this specific reading because it's difficult. It's not one that's comfortable. It's not one that we like, because we don't like to think that there will be those whom Jesus says, I don't see you. So what is it that's underneath that he's trying to teach us? What is it that a compassionate God is trying to teach us to keep us on point? Most of the patristic writers talk about these lamps and the oil is compassion. They're not physical lamps. It's not even a matter of faith. It's compassion. And if you read through, they point out some fairly stark points that are within this parable that even I didn't pick up when I first read through. For instance, they're all virgins. All 10 that are there waiting for the bridegroom are virgins. And as Augustine points out, that means that all 10 of them are very good people. It's not that you have 5 that are absolutely terrible and then they get thrown out. No, you start out with 10 very good people, all of them virgins. And each has a lamp. Each has at least in the beginning come prepared waiting for the bridegroom. And then they all fall asleep. And whether by sheer happenstance or actual intent, I prefer to think intent, our lectionary couples both the letter from Thessalonica to this reading, because many of the patristic fathers actually write about both of these at the same time, because they say going to sleep is similar to dying. It is the analogy of dying. And they bring out that same going to sleep language that Paul uses in Thessalonica. And they couple the two together. So what is it? That all 10 have now gone to sleep. All 10 have, quote unquote, gone to sleep. And then Jesus shows up. And only 5 are ready. What is it about them that prepared them, that allowed them to be so ready when the bridegroom came? As Augustine digs deeper, he says what they had was a reservoir of compassion, a deeper reservoir than the others, one that they had developed, one that they had nurtured, so that when the time came, that compassion that they had built up in their life was there present in their hearts and allowed them to enter with Christ. This is where I'm going to veer from Augustine. That's the joy of parables. You can read it many different ways. And as I often do with Augustine, I'm going to disagree. What I think we have here is another analogy. It can go a different way. When you look at the lamps, you have the light itself is compassion. That's what the world sees. The compassion that we as Christians have is something that you can see in us. In one of Paul's other letters, he said, let them know who you are by your actions, not by what you tell them. They should be able to see you and know that you lead a Christian life. So compassion is that outward sign. What the reservoir of oil is the twin sister of compassion. Because compassion is impossible. True compassion is impossible without humility. And humility is something that goes deep. That is the reservoir that has been filled. If you look at 10 people that come to you and they're all doing good acts, all of them out doing good works, 5 of those doing so because they know they're supposed to, five of whom are doing so because it comes out of their own humility, then five of those are going to have compassion fatigue and burnout. I've done it myself. Have you ever just kept doing good, kept doing good, kept doing good because you're supposed to do good without it actually coming out of a reservoir within you? If it's something that's on the surface, it's going to drain you. That compassion will dry you up in a heartbeat. And then you end up doing even worse than compassion, because then you get agitated, then you get frustrated, and then you just get all angsty. All right, I got to go feed the homeless. Fine, I'll go feed the homeless. I got to go serve one more meal. Fine. I got to go visit one more shut-in. Fine. You end up doing more damage than you're supposed to be doing good. This is what happens in compassion fatigue. It's what they warn pastors of. Those that are in Community of Hope, I know you've been talking about this, because compassion fatigue is a serious thing. So how do you prevent it? Where does compassion really come from? It comes from that reservoir of oil, that twin sister of humility. And I don't blame people for compassion fatigue, having done it myself, because going into humility is very uncomfortable. It's not something we like to do, because sitting with humility is sitting with our brokenness. Because true compassion, that is, having passion with someone, compassion, to be able to have it with someone is to recognize their brokenness in you. And the deeper you go into your brokenness, to sit there and recognize it, to sit there and appreciate it, and then have a softer touch with someone else's brokenness, then the greater the connection of compassion that you can have with someone else. So hearing this lesson from Christ, hearing this lesson from the bridegroom that says, you better have a lot of humility so that your compassion will be true, so that your compassion will be deep and sustaining. Where are you practicing humility? Before you can do outward work, we have to do inward work to get there. We have to sit with our grief. We have to sit with our own issues. And this is where we can turn to Joshua. Joshua stands before the people of Israel. They have just come into the new land. They have just gotten there. They just left Moses behind, poor soul. And now they're there, and Joshua gives them one last warning. He says, before we do this, this is your one out. Before you sign up for this, I'm going to let you walk away. It's okay. But at least know what you're about to walk into. He says, if you're going to serve God, then it needs to be God only. All the idols, all the gods that you had before you, all those gods of your fathers in Egypt, you can still worship them. It's okay. But if you do, then you need to leave. But if you're going to serve God, then we have to put those away, and there's no turning back. And then, of course, the people say, of course we'll follow God. And we all know how that story went. But that point, he says, you've got to turn away from your idols. This is our act of humility. And while Joshua says he will not forgive your transgressions, we at least know that that's not true. And thanks be to God, that's not true. Because every time we turn back to one of our old idols, God's always there waiting for us to turn back around again. But that act of humility that we have to practice, which can be a daily practice, is to sit there and figure out, what idols have I turned to? What idols have I gone back to as a means of comfort or distraction? Is it an idol of greed? Is it an idol of status? For those of you that have heard me preach enough, this should sound repetitious at this point. You know, Bishop Whitmore, I love the man. He says, I only have 5 sermons. And then one of his parishioners came up and said, Bishop, well, back then when he was a dean, he said, Dean, You only have 5 sermons. Are you going to preach on anything else? And he says, no. When we can finally get those 5 things, then I'll start preaching on something else. I like it. So, these idols. I have the same idols. These idols of status, this idol of fragile identity that I kind of have to shore up so I hope people don't see how vulnerable I am. These idols that separate me or try to protect me from the fear and insecurity in my life. There are idols outside of us that are greed, idols that are addictive behavior, idols that are of anger. All these different idols you can find, and they're so seductive because they're not physical statues like the Israelites had. These are idols of practice that are so ingrained in us, so upheld by our society that it feels normal. And they can just creep in there. And unless we sit with it in a practice of humility, intentional humility, we can just keep facing these idols again and again without realizing it. I'll give you a very practical lesson, practical example. As some of you may know, or may not, last Sunday my car died. Flights of angels managed to push it in front of my house before the engine finally said, I'm done. I have brought the youth back here after our trip down to Common Ground, and then the check battery light came on. You know what that feeling's like, don't you? That, no. That tightness in my chest, the tingling of my skin going, this is not going to be good. I had enough juice left in the battery to get me home. And Linda, thank goodness, was there to help me at least change the serpentine belt, which had split in 2, by the way. And I thought, once I got that fixed, we're great. No, it's the alternator. Completely other story. So I get the car home, and now it's time, by the way, I got it home, we're all safe. Now it's time to get a new car, because that one has reached the end of its life. It was a good car. This past week, I've been looking at new used cars to buy. I had to apply for Grad Plus loans, so it's just more money. And then the school allotted me a certain amount. They said, you are approved for this amount of money, more than I was expecting. It's like, ooh, I wonder what car I can get now. And my father, who works in a dealership, has been sending me all these new pictures of, all right, you can get this one, you can get this. I want something practical. That's how I started. I want a stick shift, and I want one that's good on the fuel and not too expensive. And it needs to have enough trunk space that I can actually move stuff now. That's where I started. And then I saw other cars that were in my price range. I saw this neat little sleek Scion that was, I can't even tell you what the nomenclature is, but it's a 2-door coupe. It's nice and sleek. It's the sports model. It's got dials on front that glow in the dark. It's got a red dash. I mean, you can't get any sportier than this. And it's right at my limit. And it's so seductive. I could imagine myself, I sit there fantasizing about driving in this little sports car, and because it's a stick shift, you feel like a sports driver already. It's fun. It's seductive. In fact, if I drove around, people would go, hey, that's a sexy car. You know what that's like. And then I have to take a step back and remember, do I really need this? Is this really what I've started with? Within our order, we have a vow of simplicity. Not poverty. This one's actually a little more difficult. Vow of simplicity means to live only with what you need, not what you want. So for us as an order, we have a daily practice of humility. It's something as simple as going to McDonald's and asking myself, do I need the large size or can I get away with a medium size? Do I really need that much? It's only 99 cents. It's that easy. But humility is a continual practice of asking ourselves, where am I beyond my limit? Where am I living into an image that isn't really my own? There are other more serious, deep practices of humility that you can practice and try as well. Within the monastic culture, there are practices and meditations on death, on loss and grief, where you have to sit there and imagine your own loss In the early Benedictine culture and communities, you would spend the first year of your novitiate down in the novitiate is your preparation period. You spend it down in the crypts, carving out your hole, because you realize that when you took your vow, that is where you would eventually be placed. It's an exercise of humility, of accepting the limits of our mortality. Now, I'm not saying that you all have to go home and practice death meditations. You know, let's not jump in the deep end. But there are practices that we can all try. Is it going out to eat, or is it staying home and actually being with family and preparing a meal around the table? Is it finding, if you're going to eat at home, is it finding something easy that comes out of the freezer or something that requires preparation and effort because you're actually offering yourselves to those around you? Or is it a frozen meal that everybody can gather around and watch TV together? Simple questions. But humility is a continual practice. It is one that we have to constantly nurture. Just like the virgins had to prepare ahead to be sure there was enough oil of humility in order to fuel the compassion that would shine and light the world when the bridegroom came. So I leave you today with a question, a practice, homework, however you want to put it. Where will you find humility? Where will you look out and take stock of yourself? Where will you reach out to others and practice humility together? The joy of living in community is that I have brothers that keep me accountable. It's not always comfortable, but they'll keep you accountable. For instance, when I was looking at the very slick 2014 Dodge Dart so that I would have both the 50-year model, which is sitting in the parking lot, I would then have the 100-year model of Dodge that would go with it. I'd have bookend pairs of Dodge Darts. Brother Addison comes up and says, "You're doing it because it's a label, aren't you?" "Yes, I'm doing it because it's a label." You know, accountability. That's why we're in community, even here. So with whom can you practice humility? Is it your partner, your spouse? Is it your children? Children are really good at holding you accountable. Is it your friend here in the parish, your friend at work, your friend in the neighborhood? Practicing humility is best done, at least in pairs. So for this week, consider, where can you practice humility? What practices can you do? Is it simply asking yourself every time you lay down a dollar, is it really what I need? Is it really a dollar that is spent for myself, or is it a dollar that is spent for the betterment of the world around us? Is it a dollar that is spent to shield my own ego, or is it a dollar that will help lift up someone else that is just as broken as I am? Simple practices of humility. And together, if we hold each other accountable, we will be able to fill that reservoir of oil. That together we will have such a reservoir of oil that the compassion that comes from this community will be a beacon of light for all those outside these doors. And that when they look at us, they will see the same hope that Paul says they will feel in the passing of loved ones. That true they are gone. Did you notice that in Paul's letter? He doesn't say that Christians won't be sad when they pass. He says both those who are Christian and not will be sad with the passing of loved ones. But that we who have filled that reservoir, that we who have led a life of true compassion, we will grieve, but do so with hope. Hope is that light that comes from compassion. How will you practice humility and be a light unto the world? Amen.